Hello, my name is Lowell, pronouns he, him, and today we are talking about Legacy Life Among the Ruins, particularly second edition of this game, which is out from UFO Press. This is a PBTA game of generational play, but I'm not sure exactly that pitch is right in some ways, but we'll talk about that. This is a game I really love. I played it in first edition. It was the first game I ran on the Gauntlet, and it may have been the worst game I ever ran on the Gauntlet, because I didn't understand it. And then later on, when the first version of the second edition came out, I ran that and it was clunky, I think is what I want to say. But as it's gone along, I've come to understand more about the game. The game itself has gotten stronger. And there's a lot I've really come to appreciate about it and some of the other iterations of it. Today, I'm going to be talking particularly about Legacy, the two supplements a little bit, Endgame and Engine of Life. And then I may be touching on Free from the Yoke and Shattered City just a little bit tangentially. I'm not going to be talking about the Worlds of Adventure, or not Worlds of Adventure, but the Worlds of Legacy set of books. Those are all very interesting and very distinct, or essentially the second or third generation spinoff, which is Void Heart Symphony. But I'm going to be focusing on these main books. And in the show notes, I will have a copy of my outline for the talk, as well as links to some other resources, including our online character keeper, as well as a link to a blog post I did a while back that walks through the basics of Legacy and looks at the materials for that. So I'm going to get started. You're going to hear me talk for a bit. I've encouraged the on Zoom audience to hit me up with questions or comments or contradictions as we go along. So you may hear that. So Legacy is generational. At least that's sort of the pitch of it. But when you actually get to play, I think that you might not see that. You may see people hanging on to their characters from age to age, which kind of moves away from the generational thing of it. You also need to play for a fairly long span of sessions to really hit that generational feel. What I think is more interesting, and what the real premise is of Legacy, is it is at two levels. It is at a high level, a family level, and that is deep and rich and consistent. It isn't just like a little overframe. And it's at the character level, which is just as rich. The other thing about this is that this is a game that is not PvP. There are tensions. There are pushings back and forth. You may end up killing each other's PCs. And I'm pointing to Alan in this particular case from the game that Jay ran. But that's kind of more of an exception than it is the rule. Then it's not like the Sword, the Crown, and the Unspeakable Power, which is very, very focused on that conflict and tension and very aggressiveness. Particularly one of the play principles of Legacy is that despite the differing agendas of the families, we have a set of core characters that are trying to work together, that are trying to find a path through. So I think that that's a really interesting thing to consider. One of the things, sort of the two kind of issues that happen in Legacy often, is that there can be a cognitive dissonance for the players between that family level and that character level. One of the things is you are playing the family level. You are the person making those decisions as a player, setting those agendas. And the question becomes, what is my character's role in that? Are they the leader? Are they giving the agenda? I think it's really important to talk about that at the start when you're running Legacy, and to maybe even decouple those two things, right? Say you're going to run the family, and kind of get yourself in that headspace, and then you're going to think about what your character feels in reaction to those character choices. And they may not agree with them. That creates a whole set of great tensions. They may become an outsider, and the different role choices can play into that. But I think that's something really important to think about and to get across to the players. Other problem that Legacy faces is that It has a metric shit ton of mechanics. It is an engine of many parts, and a lot of those gears don't actually link up with one another. They're running, and it maybe the gear will kind of hit a cog every once in a while. It had a lot of moving parts, a lot of moving pieces. And for some players, that can be really off-putting. I know Sherry is very gun-shy about Legacy, having played it several times, because of the amount of mechanics and engines. She likes, when she looks at a playbook, to be able to use the parts to solve problems. And sometimes it's unclear. You have to find out in play, like, how this is actually going to work, and it's going to change from GM to GM. So another challenge and another thing that a GM needs to be thinking about is, where are our opportunities for RP? Where do we get that? So let's start with the idea of, you're going to be setting up a Legacy game. One of the things that Legacy does is it has some premises that are baked into the world and the playbooks that I think are there regardless of which combination of family playbooks the characters choose. One, we are in the aftermath of some kind of destruction. That has happened in the far past or the near past. It's unclear. But it has happened a while ago. It is definitely the past. Something has changed. Some situation has changed within our setting such that now there's the opportunity for rebuilding and people are moving out in a more significant way, even though there have been connections and cross traffic and trade before that. And I think with very few exceptions, this is not Earth. The way these things are set up, it is not a contemporary world that has been evolved up, because there are so many things in here that kind of go against that. The book, and I'm just talking about the core book here, presents three modes of play, three kinds of playbooks. It says that some of the playbooks are what they call ruin playbooks, which supposedly aim for kind of a Mad Max, grounded, the road feel. Some of them are Echoes playbooks, which have some like stuff we can recognize, but also some weirdness, and they reference Horizon Zero Dawn, and they reference Fallout for that. And then the other ones are what they call mirror playbooks, and this is a kitchen sink. This is the high weirdness. Importantly, almost half of the playbooks of the 11 are those mirror playbooks. There are only three Ruins playbooks and there are only three Echoes playbooks. So assuming a table of four and assuming that people aren't doubling up on those, you are going to get a kind of a game that has a little bit of that weirdness present. And I think that's something that you want to be thinking about. The book suggests having a tone discussion about that. And I think there a tone discussion in terms of like how dark or how light or how gritty you want to be, I think is fine. But my general feeling is you let the players choose the playbooks and then you figure out what that looks like from there, rather than saying, okay, we're going for a gritty, you know, it's very specific, you know, Fallout tension, because that really does constrain the players. And there's so much good stuff here. People want to engage with the cool books. They want to engage with the cool playbooks. So you want to do that. Now, that's not to say you shouldn't curate, because there are some playbooks that radically change the play. In the core book, there is one that I will come back to that, if it's in play, it changes everything that's going to happen. And in the Engine Life and Endgame, there are some of those playbooks that, while they don't, I don't think they change it as much as that main book playbook, they do really shift what is happening. So I do encourage people to do that. So what I tend to do is I clip the most extreme ones that I'm like, I don't want to have to figure out the rules for these. I don't want this to overwhelm other players' choices. And then give those set of things. And then from that, we'll figure out what the world is actually going to look like. I would say that 3 to 4 players is our sweet spot. I would not run this with 5 players. And I think 3 is kind of the minimum because you can have a triangle of interactions there. That's my feeling. Other people may have different experiences on that. Once you kind of decide you're going to want to play, and let's assume you're playing online, the online keeper presents a very particular challenge. And we've answered that challenge in one way. I think that other people could answer it in a different way. I've shared this link with the participants, and I'll also have it in the show notes. This keeper that we use for Legacy Life Among the Ruins has evolved over time. The basic idea is that there are individual tabs for each player that have the details and character outlines for both their family playbook and their character playbook. They also have to the right of that space for doing quick characters based on that family. That all that stuff is there on that page. But because we found that it's often more useful for players to like interact with one another is to see everybody's character at once, there is a call out page that is our summary page. And that does lookups from each of those playbooks into the basics that are all on one tab. It is not a great solution. It works okay. And I'm sure there are other approaches to that, but this is the one that has worked for us. One of the things it does have is, at least as it stands now in the present engine, is once a player has decided on their playbook and their character things, they're going to have to manually put in copy and paste. We've got the moves in another place and some questions and things. But there are some things that are going to have to be modified depending on the character archetype. For example, you have to kind of go in and manually set up the quick characters for their roles and their inheritance moves and things like that. That's one place where those things have to be kind of set up. There are a couple of other places. You need to manually put in all of the role moves right now. Those things aren't automated. So if you choose a particular character playbook, it's not going to autofill on those things. Eventually, someone with greater skills, time, and patience than I will figure out how to do that. But right now, there's just so much stuff in there that I want you to be aware that if you're going to be using this playbook, if you're going to be using this keeper, take some time to familiarize yourself with it and what you're going to have to fix as a GM or what the players are going to need to make changes on, because it can be overwhelming. This is especially true if you're playing with people who are new to playing online or haven't played one of these legacy games before. It is a learning experience. It also is the case that the one that I'm sharing is the most updated version of the online keeper. There are a number of other versions from earlier editions that are floating out there. I believe that this one is up to date, but I encourage people, if they do use an online keeper, to check that against the rules. So you're going to go run Legacy. Super. How many sessions are you going to run? This is a real question. We say this often with PBTA that, like, well, running a month long, 4 or 5 sessions, you don't necessarily get to taste everything that game offers. Maybe you start to get the high points. Maybe you start to feel a little bit of it, especially with 3-hour sessions. That is so much more true with Legacy. If you're running 4 sessions, you're actually running 3 sessions. If you're running 5 sessions, you're actually running 4. You might, within that span, get 1 or 2 turnings of the age, which is one of the like sexy parts of the game, the moving forward in the generations. But usually it's just going to be 1. And you kind of, as a GM, need to be thinking about that and maybe even pushing towards that. I would say that a quarterly series is probably the best approach, but it is one that requires commitment. And if you're running open table, where you might get players changing out, as a GM, one of the things you want to be thinking about is what are like the factions that I've established as NPC factions? Can I slot a new player into those? Especially if they haven't played Legacy before, figure out how you want to handle that. Now, this is also going to vary based on whether you're playing online or face-to-face. And it's also going to be vary based on session length. But I'm generally running 3 hours with two breaks in there. You will never get your session zero done in one session. This is, I have tried so hard to get it all done in one session in Legacy and in Free from the Yoke, which is even easier. But one of the things about the session zero for Legacy is that it is fun. And it is a really interesting kind of mini game play space revolving around map making and history building and all of those kinds of fun and interesting bits. And you'll be doing that because you start with kind of the world building, the family building. That will eat up the available space. And then suddenly you'll realize that you need to actually make up characters to go with these families as well. And what happens, I think, every time that I've run this is we get into that last hour and I realize, I'm like David Lynch with the first Dune movie. Oh God, I've got to get, all of this stuff into the last hour of the movie. So usually what I'll do is we'll get people to make their selections about characters, get those things kind of basically set up. And then we finish off the character choices by doing the relationships at the start of the next session and kind of, going over where we're at. The most fun in some ways is the collaborative map making, the choices that you get to make about the landscape and the like decisions about what you're showing or not showing and how those relate. Those are really fun. I've done a post a couple weeks ago on the Age of Ravens Games blog about tools for collaborative map building. I think those apply here. I'll show you two different Legacy maps right now. I'm going to screen share this one here. So this is from an older Legacy map. You can see that it is done with Google Drawings. It's pretty much shapes and colors and text. And this is a very late game version of that. It will get crowded. You will note that the text is very small. I encourage you as a GM, when you go to set this up, maybe putting a couple of signposts on the map. This is something I said in my post that kind of establish the scale for how big lakes are, how big, forests are, how big a city marker should be, how big the text is. So that's one version. Now, this is using Google Drawings. I will also have a link to this, a copy of this in the show notes. The other one I will show you, I have to stop the share to switch tabs here. This is using a different system maybe a little more legible here. This is from the game that Jay ran. This is using Jamboard, which is a different tool. The text is a little bit bigger. The icons are a little more snazzy. Essentially more people were bringing in image and graphics into it to kind of make it work. I think both of these work. They're both pretty cool. I like them both. And I go and I look back at this and I can see and remember the history of how the game played out from the changes in the map. I'm going to stop the share on that. So give players time to make those choices, to build that map. One of the things that you want to do during that map making process is look and see if some people are struggling with the tools. Like, take the time to explain like how the choices are made. Be really vigilant about that, because sometimes people get frustrated with an online electronic tool and they don't say anything. It's one of the things I love about Tyler is Tyler is admittedly has issues with those things, and he always says, I need your help with this, and the players will pitch it. So check in with people. If you see somebody struggling, come in, ask them what they can do, try to help them out. Don't necessarily call attention to those limitations, but be aware and ready for that. So the first thing that we're going to be doing after we've kind of done that tone discussion, we've done our safety discussion, our cats, all of those preliminary things, is players are going to choose their families. I encourage you to have people all take different families. There are so many families between the 11 in the main book. Is it? Yeah, 11, plus another, I think, as many from Endgame and Engine of Life. Again, don't feel free that you have to use all of them. Feel free to curate, especially depending on the experience level of your players. There are some playbooks that are very complicated. I'm thinking particularly of the one that Alan ran, the Eldritch Servants, who essentially were the Cthulhuans cultists, maybe. And there's some other ones that have really weird resources and things like that. So be willing to focus in on that. One of the other things you want to be thinking about as the players choose their families as a GM is be thinking about what families haven't been taken that you can put on the board as interesting NPC factions, ones that serve as nice contrasts or nice parallels for those families. Get those onto the board. So our families, when we go to do those choices, have a mixture of things that are just color and things that have those mechanical implications. The book suggests an order for how you do those picks that I don't necessarily agree with, because there is some cart before the horse things that happen there. For one thing, I think you do history last. You do your stats and traditions. Those are easy picks that help say something about your family. Once you've got those two things picked, that's the moment where the player should go around and do a brief introduction on how they're envisioning their family. At that point, you go through and do the landmarks, get those across. You do the other picks, the other choices about a lifestyle and things like that. And then you do a little introduction, and then you do the history to build those treaty, to build those connections once we've got everything in place. That's my suggested order. I think it's one that gives the best set of information, kind of breaks up the process a little. I will mention that stats are the first choice that people make. And when we go to do introductions, the thing that kind of sometimes gets skipped over, as a GM, watch for what those stats say about the family. And maybe ask a question to follow up about how that fits into the context of things. The most interesting part of this, again, this goes back to the map building, yeah, the landmark choices. We've got the three sets of those choices, which means that We're going to go around to all the players three times. That is part of why this is going to eat up a lot of time, is that we have to go around. During this process, as a GM, you're going to be wanting to ask follow-up questions, and you're going to want to be looking at, somebody has pointed at this thing, this other thing has already been established, can I connect those? Can we maybe ask permission to make a connection to establish continuity? You're getting all these pieces on the board as a GM, you're looking at how you weave those together as a story. The other thing you're going to be doing is you're going to be fixing the map, because people will be moving things around. They'll be messing up about other stuff. They'll be making little problems. They'll be putting things in text that is 48 point when they don't want to. They'll be dropping objects on that fill thing, help people out. This is like the place where your GM duty is the most intense, is during this map making phase. You're also looking to see, okay, what are the threats that are being implied? Because those are the ones you're really going to want to hook on. You're also going to want to think, what are places that are going to have resources, meaning surpluses, because those are really interesting points for you to know to put onto the table later. A lot of people forget about establishing, because they want to put cool shit on the table, they forget about establishing some places where they can get stuff for their families. So as a GM, you want to find those and fill those in. Also look for blank spots, spots where people haven't drawn as much, spots where there's open territory. I will point out that most people will end up building a map that is inland. They will forget that maybe people live by the coast or whatnot. Unless you've got somebody who's chosen the pioneer of the depths. And even when I played with David and he did the pioneer of the depths, it was a big lake. So we were all still inland. But think about that, what the geography is at the margins. How can we keep play with that? As I said, resources are important for you to think about. And by resources, I mean things that can act as surpluses or fulfill needs, any of those things. One issue that the game presents that I think it kind of ignores, is there is a choice that the players make about their lifestyle, which is nomadic, dispersed, and settled. And I think these kind of go in passing, but I think these are hugely important to shaping what it means to be that family. Nomadic players need to, they don't have just a space. They need to define a zone that they occupy, whether that's a zone that they just move around in or whether they travel from place to place. Nomadic civilizations need larger volumes of space and areas, and they're going to be passing through those. So if somebody defines their civilization as nomadic, you need to ask about that. How far do they travel? Is this a seasonal thing? Are they going in a small area? Are they going in a large area? Nomads may have settlements, but these are often seasonal ones. Or if they're their occupiers, then what they've done is they've occupied other people's urban centers and they've got those as places that they move back and forth through. This is from my general knowledge of the steppe nomads and that kind of thing. It may differ if you have other cultural area knowledge, but that's something to think about, is that nomadism means a certain kind of movement. Dispersed is an odd choice, is because it implies that you have a family or an ethnographic group or an ethnic group or a social group or a religious group or something like that, that is in many different places within the what they call the homeland, this larger area, which suggests that they've spread out over time or they've been shattered, and you need to think about that. It means that they are probably in with other settlements. So we do need to have some settlements on the map, either NPC settlements that they're present at or other player settlements. And we need to think about the implications of that. Are there some places where they are dispersed, but they're the majority population? Or, you know, how do they fit in? Whereas the nomads, the challenge is maybe about movement and environment and pressures there. Dispersed families have challenges about communication, about maintenance of traditions, about the pressures of other populace within those same settlements. So there's a really interesting set of questions there. I've been listening to an audiobook on Central Asia and how the different groups got dispersed there in the 19th and 20th century, how that was broken up into different places, and how that radically changed the notion of what it meant for these people to be a population or a people. And then settled, generally we think of these as urban, but it doesn't necessarily mean like they have a city. It can be that they've settled in one place and they have I'm going to say this, I have a Hoosier accent, a rural agricultural community, that kind of thing. People kind of need to think about that. Really interesting opportunity to say something about who these families are at that point. Resources. All the playbooks have a list of 5 resources. Players choose 2 of them to be surpluses normally. That's what they have a lot of. And they choose the others. I think 2 or 3, and I have to look at things, but there are others that are needs, meaning what they lack. That's an important thing. One of the questions as a GM you should be asking a lot is, what does having a particular need look like? What does it mean to not have defenses? What does it mean to not have leadership? Like those are real points of pressure that you can hit on. Okay, yeah, so it is 2 standard and 3 needs for most people. These resources are interesting because we have very concrete resources like food and medicine, but then we have some very abstract ones like progress. So that's another place for asking some open-ended questions to the players is, what does progress look like? You have a surplus of progress. What does that mean to your family? That kind of thing. So again, another great place to hit. Players, one of the last things they get to choose for their families are assets. Everyone will forget that you only get to choose 3 of these. They give you a list of 4 kinds of assets, and it looks like you should pick 1 from each. No. You pick 3. Everyone will forget that. So make sure during that process that you remind people of that. It provides a really hard choice at the start. Like, you're going to have to leave off one of these 4 important areas. A lot of times people will leave transport off. And if they do, that's, you should ping on that and see what it means that you can't get transport. The last thing that you get with that family playbook is your alliance move. This is the major source of treaty. You're going to start with some treaty from your history, but your alliance move is the other big engine for you. And some players, some playbooks have very easy alliance moves and some do not. As a GM, you need to be aware of what everybody's alliance move is so you can point people towards that. So you can give them opportunities. So you can lean into that, especially where a player doesn't have a particularly easy to activate, a very contingent alliance move. Remembering that alliance moves can also trigger in relation to NPCs. You want to get NPC factions out there so players can also be generating those. I'm going to take a drink. Some of the families have very interesting implications to them. The cultivators, for example, they have a move that is based on time passing. It triggers at the start of the age, but their key move then requires time to pass. So they want the age to go longer so that they can activate that. That's a force that goes through that. Some of the playbooks are very basic and classic. The Enclave of Lore, the Merchants are both real classic. The Merchants are based on interactions with other factions. The Lawgivers, when somebody takes the Lawgivers, you want to be looking at what the implications are of that family and how fascist they are. I think that you want to be checking in with people. You want to be comparing that to the lines and veils and tone that you've got set for that. The Pioneers I mentioned open up oceans. The Servants of the Faith deal with questions of religion and faith. And if somebody does take the Servants, you may want to have a conversation about what that means if people are strongly invested in their own real world faith and how much this comments on that. The one though that I want to point out from here, and I think all of you know this already, the Order of the Titan completely reshapes the game. It does this in two ways. One is that it adds these titans in as a constant threat that the other players have to deal with. And two, nearly all of the really good Order of the Titans moves require that those threats be out there. Like they trigger off of that. And unless they're present and unless they're being interacted with by the other players, their moves kind of suck. And I've seen Order of Titan players get really frustrated because like they kind of need to be constantly doing things. A lot of them are very, very contingent on other groups. I think that if someone really wants to play the Order, I think that's fine, but they should know that that's a thing and you should have a conversation with the group about that. I don't think any other playbook, even from the expansions, nearly changes things so much as that does. And I've felt bad for players who have chosen that and have been very excited about it. And then when we've got to play, other players are pursuing their agendas. They want these Godzillas, these kaiju out there. But like you can't do that every age. If every age is like that, it gets a little wearing. So that's my comment on the families. Let me open up and see if anybody has questions or comments that they'd like to add about any of the families, their thoughts on that before I kind of move to characters. Jay, it seems like you're...
Yeah, my space key isn't working.
That's okay.
The Order of the Titan, I'm with you there. And I always thought maybe that's a specific campaign kind of play. Maybe, right? Maybe we say, hey, I'm going to run Legacy. We're going to focus on Order of the Titan, right? At least one player has to be that family. Everyone else is in support or on board knowing that that's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
But you just said a thing that makes me rethink that now in that... Every age, right? It could be monster of the age kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. And that does get old, right? That does, yeah. So now I have to rethink, if I run it for, let's say a quarter, I'm with you there too. I need more than 4 weeks. I need more than 4 sessions.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do with the Order of the Titan?
One of the things is that so many of the, like the, I think it's the Kaiju warning system, requires you to help out the other players in different things. And so I think that's the real challenge. One of the interesting things that you could do, if I were like going to do a Kaiju center campaign, is I would make up a set of Kaiju with very different effects.
Right.
And very different threats.
Right.
And maybe put those out there for the group to choose. Like this one is the one that is going to reshape the weather. And this one is the one that is going to breed and create mini kaiju. Like go through all of the Zilla and Gamera films and find some cool stuff.
That's a cool idea. I like that.
Yeah.
I ran a campaign of Shattered City, where one of the players, I think it's called the Order of Kiradar in that book. So because we haven't talked about it much, I'll just give a very brief précis of, Shattered City. So it's based on core legacy, as it were. A lot of the playbooks are very strongly based on existing playbooks. There's more changes to them than them just being reskins, but at the same time, you can very clearly see kind of the origins for them, and as I said, the equivalent to the Order of the Titans works in a very similar way. But it worked out really well in the campaign of that I ran. They were a really interesting faction. Got to do some fun stuff. But I think the thing with Shattered City is as the name suggests, all set in a city. Which means that if a Titan is bearing down on the city, the other families don't get to ignore it, because they are always in the firing line because they're in the same place, kind of thing. So there's that kind of, I think, more imminence to everything. And also the Titan equivalents, the sort of the dangerous creatures of the world, are a bit more baked into the core setting. Whereas because Legacy is designed to be very determined by what people pick in character creation, there's just a bit more, I think, inclusion of them in that. So I found that they work really well in Shattered City. So, but I love that playbook. I think I absolutely get the kind of, it can be awkward to work that their shtick into things. But it's such a cool shtick to work into things. I think it is a very interesting one. Yeah,
I have a thing I'll say there. But Alan, you have something you wanted to add?
Yeah, only I think that in the same way that the Titans shift the direction of play, I think so do the Eldritch Servants, because every other family faction has to then define their relationship to that Eldritch power. And if you were hoping to play something that doesn't involve an Eldritch power, you're screwed, really. there is something about the way that again turns the game in a very particular direction, and I can't see how you get out of that without taking that faction out.
Brian makes a really good point in the chat here. He said maybe with the having that Order of the Titan book in there, maybe you want to have some more moves, maybe an interesting waxing waning to the kaiju. One of the things that occurred to me is, of course, I'm playing a lot of Monster Hunter Rise, is that part of the sort of play cycle of that is the harvesting of resources from defeating the big monsters. And maybe that's something to think about, is how the beyond what the Order of Titan gets, if there's some other potential benefits to incentivize players to be really cool and interested in dealing with the kaiju. Let me now talk about character. So again, just like the session zero of a legacy game, we're a ways into the talk and we're only just now getting to characters. There are some wild playbooks in the main book, and especially in the secondary book, but I don't think any of them I would necessarily leave out. There are a couple that are have some I would leave out, maybe based on the mechanics being difficult to process. But generally, in terms of what they do, I think almost all of them can fit even in other games, because you can work out like what this actually means. What does it look like? What does a warlock look like in a very conventional game? Like, what's going on there? And I think there's a lot of fun to be had about figuring out that connection of things, and how they end up actually playing out. Again, I'd encourage players to all choose different playbooks, and there are enough of them for that to be possible. It does get a little tricky when the turning of age comes and people start changing playbooks about the overlap on that, but I think that's a conversation that you have. As I mentioned before, one of the challenges you're going to have once players have kind of chosen their playbooks and stuff is they're not going to necessarily want to let go. And there are processes for that. When you do the turning of age, you want to think about that. As a GM, like, my instinct is I want to go 100 years down and see what comes next. But that's not the player's push. So you have to be willing to let them go. Oh, I think we just go 10 years. And you're like, okay, I guess that's fine. Just recognize that pressure is there. As I mentioned before, establish early how that split is between the players as characters and the players as family leaders. Players have a pretty narrow set of moves that they can take for their characters. They don't get that many, even with advancement, but it's still a pretty small book of them. Remember that players also have access to the four inheritance moves from their family, and some of those are very cool. So if a player is maybe frustrated that they don't have a lot of great choices, A, they could choose from another playbook, but also those inheritance moves are interesting and very flavored to their family. In character creation, we have backstory questions. People sometimes forget that these backstory questions, these relationship questions, have a mechanical effect. And that is, if you are interacting with somebody and going to help them, if you have a relevant, air quotes here, relevant backstory, you can roll the assist with advantage. People sometimes forget that, but also relevant backstory is very broadly defined here. So basically, if you have a relationship, which you will, most of the time you'll get that benefit there. As a GM, sometimes you might be kind of like narrowing your eyes about that, but the game is rough enough that you should feel free about letting players take advantage of that. That's the call for aid move. And the call for aid move, I'm going to come back to this, but let's hit this point. It is very easy to forget this. The call for aid move is the character level help move, and it happens after the roll. And it will, it can be a variable stat that you're using, and it raises a result by a category. So it's really nice. On the other hand, if they roll a fail, then they take the result down to disaster. This is a place where you have the relevant backstory advantage. One of the things as a GM you need to decide is, if somebody does call for aid and fucks it up, do you allow a third player to then call for aid on that calling for aid? Like, you need to make that decision. It can look really messy at the table, but it can create some hilarious stories. That's just a choice that will happen. Don't instinctively go, no, you can't do that. Decide for yourself. Like, think about it. Don't just like go, well, obviously not. This is something that I've seen in all the legacy games where it's a desperate race to get that absolute bottom disaster there, and it's terrible. One of the things that sometimes happens in legacy games is that you know the families, and you know the PCs, and you don't know anybody else. Don't know any other characters. Don't know who they are. We may learn some people when we get to doing quick characters. We might get one or two people. One of the things, and this is something I forget, and I was reminded of this the other day. I'll give my example of this. We were playing Aegon, and John was running it, and we're doing a one-shot, and we have our characters, and we do our little roll in the boat, and we arrive, and we've got other people on the boat, and he gives names to all the other people on the boat, and just a little bit of a descriptor. Like they come and say, like, and he's got five or six other troops in the boat. And just doing that enriched our picture of what that sea voyage was like. It gave us an emotional connection to those people. One of the things I think you want to ask whenever you get a chance is when we get a scene of a person in their homeland or with their family, people, who are you talking to? Do you have relatives? Who's your uncle? Who do you care about? Like, get names of people, get them established out there. They might eventually become quick characters, but really take the time to do that. We need to see that picture. It's the same problem that we sometimes see with Blades in the Dark. Is because Blades in the Dark works through those mechanical cycles, we sometimes forget where the RP is, where the role play is, especially during that downtime. Take the chance to ask, get those names, get pictures for NPCs, build up that NPC thing. Because those NPCs, you know, as we go through the turn of the ages, we may see them become a PC, or we may see their relationship to characters change. It's worth having those out there. The other sort of funky system in Legacy is this idea of roles. In the basic book, we have four roles. If you take nothing else from Endgame and Engine of Life, I would encourage you to bring in the traitor and the prophet roles from those, because that increases the range of choices that players have. Roles, at the start, players choose a role. And as a GM, you have to decide, because there's some triggers and some pushes that it has. You have to decide, are they in that role and that trigger has already been fulfilled? Or are they in that role but now they need to fulfill that trigger? That's unclear from the rules text about that choice. So keep an eye out for that. There are two ways that roles change. Roles change in play if the trigger for another role happens and the player wants to shift roles. They can do that. They mark that new role. They get to take an advance, which usually means a new move. Otherwise, the other place that players are going to change is when the age turns, they can change role there. The book says that you retire your character when you hit your fourth role. But it's unclear, like, does that happen immediately? Does that happen at the end of session? My general feeling for this is, if somebody hits their fourth role, say, okay, like, where do you want the endpoint to be? Is this the session that you wrap? You know, make it clear to them that is the progress marker of the game. And when they've made that choice to do that, we need to be talking about, does their character retire? Where do they go from there? It's a little unclear in the rules, so I think that's something you need to be thinking about that. Uh, that there are also some questions about what happens when people change playbooks, because that's a possibility at the changing of age. It's unclear how much people carry over from a previous playbook. I would say that I think you should be pretty liberal about that, because people aren't going to get that many advances with the character. So if they do change to a new playbook, if there are some moves that aren't like quintessentially the core idea of their previous playbook, if they want to bring some of those over, they can. Or maybe you say, okay, you had gotten two advances in your previous playbook. When you go to your new playbook, you can take two advances from the new playbook. But you need to make a decision about that. That's a question that is going to come up. The last thing is, death moves are really interesting. Death moves are really, really interesting. We sometimes forget about them, but it's another thing, like the alliance moves, that as the GM, you should look at what everybody's death move is and put that out on the table as an offer. Like, hey, look at your death move. Look at this. You know, you're kind of in a bad place. Maybe you want to do that. It will come up more easily with quick characters, but PCs have these very cool death moves as well. So you want to consider that. Any questions, comments, thoughts about playbooks?
I felt like the death moves help players transition into larger age jumps, right? They're more likely to give up their character if the death move is seen like a reward and you entice them to use it. Mm-hmm. I'm with you. When I've ran it, folks want to hang on to the characters they have. And when I say, let's jump 100 years, they balk. I say, well, how about 50? Let's do 50. And you're right, it's usually 10. But I think I found, like you said, with death moves, if you present them as kind of an award, mm-hmm. right, that helps them. Because that character's, in most cases, has died. And now when we turn the age, they're less likely to hang on to time because they don't have that character anymore.
Yeah, yeah. Alan?
Sorry, lost the unmute. Okay. I think there is something about that transitional playbook and the lack of clarity in the rules about what stays, what goes, do you reset to zero? I think that's a real barrier to encouraging people to indulge in a change. And there was just something you were saying about you wouldn't necessarily, Lowell, curate the playbooks. It does strike me, because there's the Herald, the Martyr, and the Warlock, which have profoundly different stat arrangements.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the other ones are fairly straightforward, but those three do some really strange things with stats. And it might, you know, that might be for an experienced group. And I speak as someone who wasn't experienced when they played two of those playbooks. and learning on the job was quite a challenge.
Yeah, the Herald, the Martyr, the Warlock, those are all like ones that I definitely have asterisks in my mind. I think that's worth saying. David, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I was just going to chime in and say, I don't know if this is so much for right now, or maybe it's more for in play, but I think because we were just talking about that kind of issue, I think one of the things I absolutely like try and evangelize with Legacy or anything like that is the old Apocalypse World adage of, you know, treating your characters like stolen cars. I get the impulse to try and kind of keep your character going and, you know, get invested in their long story and stuff, but I think the game plays so much better, and just you get much richer stories when you do actually have quite a high churn rate of characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm a big proponent of, you know, trying to get some turns of the ages in, of really pushing to have characters switch in and out and stuff like that. So I think that's always one of the things I do want to kind of, I like to evangelize about the game. I think it might be, you know, if you are kind of more used to playing like, longer term, you know, getting a character from level 1 to 20, it can be a difficult idea to embrace, but I really think it is worth doing. And I think the game really shines when you start getting that kind of ever-shifting cast of, mm-hmm. of characters in it.
I will say this, you have a group that's hesitant about that kind of play, this is one of the things that Free from the Yoke kind of moves away from. Free from the Yoke, the implications is when the turning of age comes, it is a season that passes or a year that passes. There are times that there's much more of a sense of continuity of character. It is much more like, say, the Great Pendragon campaign or Darkening of Mirkwood or those kinds of things. So if you have a group that is hesitant about that, that's another option, a path to go down. So the biggest problem that as a GM that you're going to have, that's a good point. Putting that discussion to cats actually is a really good place to, when you do that setup, to talk about what people expect or want from the generational moments is a good thing to have at the start and make clear and get agreement on. When you're running, players will not know what to do and will not know how to do it. They will be sitting there going, what am I supposed to do next? What the hell? I don't know. I have a short list of things that are my go-tos when that happens. When I come to a player, when I'm playing or when I'm pushing a player. Number one, always be, what are their needs? What does their family need? And how can they clear those? Are there things on the map that they can clear them with? Do they need to go and do some research to find that? They need to get those needs cleared. Number two, there's always going to be at least one threat out there. Push people towards dealing with the threat. Can they deal with that threat directly, or do they need to explore how to deal with that threat? Number three, are there weird or unknown or blank spaces around where their family is? Go look there. If there's a weird lab or a strange mountain, go there. It's an opportunity for zoom in, you know, a chance to kind of do a little quick thing. Check their alliance move. How do you get more treaty? How can you lean into that? How can you set it up so that you're going to get treaty on the other characters? And then the reverse of that, if you have a bunch of treaty on other families, use it. Use it to do something. How do you put that into play? What is it you want? And how do you go and call on them? Look at their playbook moves. Some playbook moves, like the merchant's playbook moves, are very contingent on interactions with other groups. So how do they get those moving? And then last, and this is usually a ways into the game, if you have a bunch of surpluses, are there any of those wonders that match up with those surpluses? Go and look through all of the wonders, see if you've got a couple of three that fit, and is that wonder applicable to what your agenda is? I will say, and I may be jumping a little bit ahead here, I love the idea of wonders, but it's like sometimes I wish there were more of them. When we played Jay's game, I had a bunch of surpluses, but none of the wonders that linked up with those surpluses were really what my family wanted. And that's tough. So one of the things that you want to consider then with that is maybe players can be trading surpluses for other surpluses, or how do they convert one surplus to another? That's an interesting move to push them to. How do we start? Well, I think the first way we start is we take a 5-minute break here, and then we will continue on. So let's take a 5-minute bio, continue on, and we're going to talk about how we get to play, a little bit of the secondary things, and I want to open up to a larger Q&A for everybody. Okay, so let's take five. So one of the questions is, where do we start that first session? We've got our characters in play. The assumption is that the age has just turned. And the book says to start with a threat. And I think that's a good place to start. There are a couple of mechanical ways that you can frame that up. One is there is some kind of gathering or conference or discussion to talk about that threat or some other event that draws the PCs together. That gives them both that they already know each other, they have a chance to talk, and they also kind of represent their family's interests. So there's kind of an overlap there. Number two, as a GM, you say X threat has magnified, something distinct has changed about this threat. And now you kind of have a meta discussion about how the PCs are wrapped into trying to deal with that or trying to find out more about that. The other possibility is just something weird has appeared, like a monolith or a strange dome or whatnot. And then the PCs are on the road. It's a good opportunity to like pair up the PCs, you know, put them together, the pairs that fit, have a little RP with them, and then they meet the other pair and they arrive at the weirdness, they get to investigate. It allows the group to interact. We're at the PC level. They get to do something, accomplish something, and change something about the game state. And then we zoom back out to the family level. And that's the point at which then, okay, we move back to the family level for the first time. Now let's talk about what your families want. What should they be doing? Family moves can be a real opportunity to like have the PCs cross paths, to bring them in. Especially early on, it's a good way to kind of showcase what a family move looks like. Like if they're calling on treaty or they're talking to somebody else or trying to get information, it's a good way to do that. That interaction is often pretty good, but there are some places where it can get a little wonky. For example, I want to point to one of the family moves that causes, I think, the biggest headache when you are adjudicating as a GM, and that is conduct diplomacy. Conduct diplomacy says when you call on your family's allies, say what you want from them and roll reach. And one of the things you get is, as a choice, is a meeting with one of their VIPs. Well, if they're not already meeting with the VIP, what is happening there? Narrating what that looks with a PC interacting with that can be a problem. So you want to be as generous, I think, with what players get out of that move as possible. And it is a good chance to narrate like maybe how one PC helps one another. One of the other problems about the conduct diplomacy move is the 7-9 move. The 7-9 result is always that somebody else helps you. And now you have to choose a group that you give treaty to. Think about like how that works, how that fits. Sometimes it might seem a little obtuse. One of the things I try to stress when they do conduct diplomacy is that this isn't just going asking for a favor. This isn't just using treaty. This is something big that is happening there. So you want to give weight to that move when you do that. As I mentioned before, family aid works very differently from PC aid. I'm kind of talking about play now. I mentioned that family aid is stated before the roll. When your family throws its weight behind another role plus your treaty with them. So that's another reason to have that treaty. On a hit, you give them fleeting advantage. On a 7-9, you're exposed to danger. So that's an important one. And it's another question where you could have a cycle of families helping families helping families. So you want to decide how you want to handle that. Remember that you can only get advantage once. So check with around on what people do. Sometimes people say, well, I'm going to spend tech, and somebody will say, well, I want to help. Kind of slow that down, because tech can be spent to help out. But if somebody wants to lend aid, you don't want to undercut two people's things there. The book isn't necessarily clear on this, but not all scenes that have PCs in them are zoom-ins. The book kind of suggests that when you go to the PC level, sometimes there's a lot of moments when PCs are just talking to one another, when they're just getting those RP moments that aren't zoom in, so you don't have to engage the full zoom in set of rules. Generally, my play cycle is we do a family move, we go once around on that. We do that until a natural zoom in occurs. Somebody wants to explore something unusual. There's a threat that needs to be dealt with. A PC is definitively going to do a thing. Not all of those have to be resolved by zoom-ins. You can resolve them abstractly with another move. It can be fun to do those. Sometimes players will want to do that because the claim by force move sucks. It is the move that it shows the cost of war, but it is definitely kind of a losing game. You want to be in a really good position to do claim by force so that you don't get a ton of costs associated with things. There is a move that I have forgotten about nearly every time I've run, called In Want. It's on page 68 of the book. And basically is when perils looming over your family threaten to come to pass, you roll plus needs. On a 10 plus, you pick one of your needs. On a 13 plus, the GM picks another. For each need selected, the other players pick a crisis that it creates. That is if you're stuck and you want to kind of move things forward, or if a player you want to, I think, let's say they've rolled a family move and they've got a fail on it, and you want to kind of abrogate responsibility, to quote the bankers, that's a good time to do that and kind of spread out or declaim responsibility. That's a good chance to use that move. Zoom-ins. Zoom-ins are some of the most fun things to do, but you need to do them very fast. They need to be done fast. They need to be in a block. They should never take up the whole session. Again, I have a 3-hour session that I'm running, and they are in three blocks, 3 1-hour blocks plus the breaks. Figure out right away what the goal is, who the core PC is, check in and see if any other PCs can get in there. And get that fast. Some people, well, I don't know if I can. Okay, well, you don't think you're going to be there? Let's go on. You're going to make a quick character. Get to those things fast. Making quick characters is super fun. If you do it early, people get used to that process, and it will be, a joy that they can do. Do the intros fast. Super fast. This is my quick character. This is my relation to them. I think this is this, talk, do that. Don't drag that out too much. The most wonky and slowing down portion of the zoom in is tooling up. Tooling up is the point at which your character goes, okay, my family has these assets, so they're going to take these things with them. And then they're going to get to choose some additional tags. And then they're going to look at their surpluses, and they're going to get tags for those. And then they're going to look at their tool up move. It's the place where things will slow down. take it slow the first time, and then later on kind of try to make it move a little more quickly. One of the problems I have with the tooling up move is often it takes more time than you actually get payoff for it in play. Like you do all this time tooling up, and then those things don't come into play all that much. So keep that tight. It almost feels to me sometimes like I would like a Blades in the Dark style system for the gear and tooling up. I think that would be an interesting adaptation. One of the things that people could take with tooling up is followers. Try to keep it that like not everybody is bringing a group of followers, because that gets weird and untenable and looks strange. If one person is bringing followers, and let the main character kind of have a first dibs on that, then maybe just encourage that to happen. Followers get spent. There is an under orders move, which you roll with their quality. They go and do something. They can take harm. If their quality gets reduced, they get knocked out. Easy thing to do. Very, very quick. Get into the action. Like, start them on the road. Start them on the road right away. We're on the road and there's a move facing you right now. Somebody needs to do this move. All the characters, PCs and quick characters, should have the opportunity before you get to the big climax to do at least one roll, to activate one move, or to make one big important choice. That's the thing. Give them a chance to do this. You want this moment, you start in medias res, we do a little bit of setup, we get to the thing, we answer some questions, maybe people die and we activate death moves, which here, this is a great chance to kill people. I really encourage you to kill off quick characters, because it is a devastating cost, but people get cool death moves. So don't feel bad that everything in a zoom in should be hard moves. They should not be soft moves. They should be hard moves. They should cost. So I want you to keep that in mind. There are two moves that seem very close to one another at the character level, but they do quite different things. But I want you to as a GM, to remember both of these are there. One is Forge a Path. Forge a Path is the, when you find a way across precarious or dangerous terrain, that means we have already gotten to a place, we see the threat, we see the terrain that is ahead of us, and that role is used doing force, okay? That's like, we've already got there, we're already in the dungeon or whatnot. That's our In the Labyrinth move in some ways. On the other hand, Wasteland Survival is the on the road move. It's the, okay, we're moving through a strange place, somebody roll Wasteland Survival. That kind of is the, we get the Peter Jackson zoom of the characters, the panning in as they're walking along. That's our moment for that. Plus Wasteland Survival has some nice benefits potentially. So remember that those two moves have different spaces. I would not do a zoom in more than once per session. Like if it looks like maybe we get a second zoom in, I might futz around and see if we can push that off to the start of the next session. Because it's a nice pace changing event. But I don't think, just because the energy that's involved with it, that we want to do more. Treaty. One of the things I have found with Treaty is a great mechanism in this game. Some players will not want to use Treaty. It will vary from player to player. Some players, Alan, will be super aggressive about using Treaty on other players. Some players will be hesitant. Remind players that Treaty is something they've already committed to. It's soft power that's already put out there. It isn't like you're going and blackmailing them. They've already said, we're going to help you, and now you're calling on that aid. One of the things you have to decide with as a GM is if a player who has Treaty 5 goes and makes a demand on a player who has Treaty 4, like, how would we run that down? Is it treaty counter treaty? Or is it spend one and then the other person has to decide whether they make that roll to hold together or give in? If it is run to the bottom, I think maybe you want to stop and say, how much are you willing to commit? And like have them message the GM. Like, okay, I'm willing to put three treaty into making him do this. You know, and they may have to spend less because the other person isn't willing to spend any, or they're willing to spend less. But that's an important thing to keep in mind there. We talked about the turning of age. We talked about determining the length and how that goes through. I encourage you before you run, and then later on, go back and review the turning of age rules, because they are kind of complicated. There are a lot of sets of choices, refamiliarize yourself with them. Because there's some mechanical, like roll and make choices, sometimes you kind of want to rush through that, but these are places where there are real opportunities to narrate the changes, especially on the trials or fortunes that they get. And if they add a new custom, or if you're using Engine of Life and you bring the festivals in, there's real chances to do that. Two players can take the same trial. Some people will kind of not want to do that, but they can take the same trial, just because there's just a very limited palette of those. And this is a place where I actually think some additional development, like somebody could easily write a whole nother set of these, would be cool. There are other things I have here on my agenda, but I think I want to pause and open this up to some questions. If there are things you'd like me to talk about, or if you have questions or topics or insights that you would have, because we got a little bit less than 30 minutes potentially left. And you can see those of you at home can see I've got projects, other materials, hacking, all that stuff. Anything anybody wants to ask about or say or comment on? I know, you know, some of you have played more than others with this or futzed around with the rules. Jay?
So for me, I always get caught, and I'd like some thoughts about homeland versus wasteland, right? A lot of times, especially at the beginning, right, we're putting things on the map, and in my head, I have a separation, but as things unfold, right, it becomes unclear where the borders are, and then certainly while we're playing, right, and then usually what trips me up is the wasteland survival move. Do we make that while we're traversing inside the homeland, right? If I know for sure we're in the homeland, but the homeland isn't all safe, or should it all be safe, right? And maybe it's all spelled out in the book and I just need to read it better, but that's where I am.
Yeah, no, I think that the term homeland is weirdly used. And it does represent the whole map in how the book spells it out. But I do think that it needs to be like really where the civilization is. It's why I kind of want to know where the nomads go.
Right, right.
Like I want to know that path.
Right.
But I make wasteland survival rules when they're wandering, even in those settled areas.
Okay.
Especially if there are threats out there. Anybody else? Alan?
Yeah, it is that thing about the homeland. That's where I can't get my head around. And I think you've expressed it really, is that when you're putting landmarks down and threats down, those are landmarks and threats in the homeland. And then all the additional stuff you then put in that space outside. You know, I'm struck, Jay, by that there are two pages in your Jamboard map.
Right.
One of which has settled lands in the middle. And then the other one is detailed of the settled lands. And we never made that distinction.
Right.
And I think that would make it much simpler as when you're using Wasteland Survival or not, because you're not in the Settlelands, you're in the Wastelands.
Right.
Oh, interesting. Like focusing in the map and then opening it up more broadly.
Yeah.
Because that would create all that extra space for those additional NPC factions and, you know, turning of the age threats that appear from outside.
Right.
Or are located outside and you have to travel to the Wasteland to get there. Because
mm-hmm.
it is the trouble with the rules, as I endlessly bang my head against them, is that they're not terribly tight, and I like to understand a set of rules tightly.
Yes, I'm with you. I love this game, but that trips me up right there.
Yeah, you know, when I first played Legacy, I had thought that it was a little bit more like Forbidden Lands from Free League, mm-hmm. in the idea that there are these different settlements and something closed them down, and now that has risen up and now they're interacting. But that's not true, because what you build up establishes connections and trade and traffic and interrelations and things like that. So I do think, like, that's a really interesting idea that hadn't occurred to me about making the map larger than. Part of it is because I use the Google drawings, and it'd be very hard for me to make the map larger. So there is a practical limit for me there.
Right.
Can I just add then that would also, I think, help with this? Because I always struggle with settled nomad, because then nomads are anywhere in the settled lands, in the core map. And in a way, you don't then need to get sucked into what's your migration route?
Yeah.
In detail, we're all over this place, or we're dispersed through this place, or that's where we live. And again, that would make it much more concrete for me, because that's what I need.
It would make it easier, I think, for the kaiju stuff too. Like if they're coming into the homeland,
mm-hmm.
the homeland is everything that people have control over, that people have access to. So the threat is present and shared. Interesting.
And it would allow you to have a whole chunk of stuff outside the settled lands, which was the sea. And then you're introducing fundamentally different kind of kaiju, which would mean a turning of an age and a new behemoth.
Could be more interesting. Yeah.
It does also do another thing. One of the things that is like for the tyrants is, they get like benefit when they take over settlements. And so assuming that everything that is kind of a settled place in the homeland is that makes that fair game. And then you can put sort of the wildlands and other threats and resources available outside the fringes. That's a really good idea. I wonder if other people are doing that, and it just never occurred to me. And they're all like, God, lol, you know?
No, it's murky. Like I said, in the three games that I've ran, I started with that separation in my head. But by the time we've got through the map making part, it was murky. And because I didn't have, I don't have a rule to point to and say no, it explicitly says, this is how it is, right? I take the, you know, let the players have it. This is not the hill I'll die on. And so, and then I'm caught with the wasteland survival move,
mm-hmm.
right? Especially when, and we've had that in our game, when we're moving through spaces that in my head, we're in the homeland. So it can't be that dangerous.
Right.
I had a quick look at the handout, and it has the bit you're supposed to draw the map in, and it's just labeled the homeland, and that covers the whole thing.
Yeah.
But I also feel like there should be a distinction between the homeland and whatever is outside of it. And then those borders can fluctuate.
Like you
reclaim an area and that sort of, or you lose something to a threat. But
that's a really good point. Let me come back to wonders, because mm-hmm. this is something we talked about before. Alan mentioned the idea that should you encourage players to aim for a particular wonder and fail, or say accumulate surpluses and pick a wonder that fits. So this points to one of the issues in the mechanics about wonders. When you put resources out for a wonder in the mechanics, are you putting it at risk? The book seems to suggest that that is the case. You have to get it to a place and it has to be working on a thing. So that's a real challenge. Now, one of the points being, and the ideas of the book, is that somebody starts the wonder, other people also commit to it. And they get benefits for committing to that, or having overlapping surpluses with that wonder. I think as a GM, you need to make that decision and talk about how you want to handle wonders. If I were going to, set down the rules, I would say, when you want to start a wonder, you need to say, I'm starting it, and commit at least one resource to it and put that at risk. If you want to sit on the other ones that you're putting together, I'm okay with that, but at least one needs to be put out there. And if you commit just one surplus and somebody else, and you hang on and sit on the other ones, but somebody else comes in and they want to commit, they'll take that slot. They'll take that space. They can fulfill that surplus requirement there, so that they can kind of get in on it and contest ownership. Because that's the thing. Whoever I believe puts the most in or completes it, I think, is the owner. And you have to take a look at the rules on that. That makes it sort of a competition. But one of the things I would say is, as a GM, if somebody commits a resource to a wonder, I wouldn't hit that with a move. I would threaten it maybe, but I wouldn't hit it to take it away. If other players want to try and take that surplus from the site, they're welcome to, and make that a tension thing there. But that would be my feeling about those projects and things. I'd also say some of the projects are very weird from the secondary books. Look at the implications of of them before you say, yeah, you can do that wonder. There's some big changes that they can have. David? You're mute.
I am indeed. Thank you. I was just going to sort of say, and I kind of touched on this sort of already before, but I just wanted to say a bit about the player experience, I suppose, as well, of the game. And I think the way that you approach this game is really important, and I think that's one of the things that I find really interesting about it. And I think you absolutely can play it like a standard RPG, standard PBTA game, and it's fine, it's perfectly workable. But I think it does really, I think the game really sings when you do embrace that kind of level of abstraction that the game introduces. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of comes in a couple of things in I know that we mentioned with the zoom ins about trying to run it quite hard, get it in medias res, but that's also very much a thing for the players to be aware of as well. It's the moves that you have both at the player and at the family level are very, very powerful. I mean, even for a PBTA game where, yeah, generally, the moves aren't too concerned about blow to blow combat or stuff, in this the player level combat moves, Seize by Force is the family one, isn't it?
Fiercely Assault.
When you make the Fiercely Assault roll, that is you winning a battle. It's not you shooting somebody. That is depending on the exact tactical split up, you might do it in kind of tactical stages or whatever, but making that move is you achieving an objective. It's not just, oh, I shoot a guy in the leg. It's a big momentum changing thing. And I think that's something that's important to bear in mind is that sort of it's it's not a game. It's like I said, it's a game where you can very much focus on kind of personal level drama and all that sort of good stuff like you do in other games. But I think it really, like I said, I think the best parts of it are when you lean into that, like achieving big things, making big changes, drilling down into your family or drilling out into your family, exploring other people's families. And all that side of things, I think where the real strengths of the game are. And it can be, because there's a lot to keep an eye on, there's a lot of moves, there's a lot of stuff to learn about the game. I think it can be easy to kind of fall into familiar patterns of playing a game, when I think that like coming in with a bit more of that, like, you know, top-down writer's level view, even as a player, is quite an important. I mean, like I said, it's not. I'm not saying it's essential. I'm not saying you have to play the game like that, but I think it really does help to kind of take that approach to it.
Agreed. If you want to hack or reskin Legacy, let's talk about reskin here first. What do you need to change? What do you need to look at? You need to curate the playbooks, the families, get them down to a manageable level, like the 6 or 7 that you think fit. Don't do more than that because it'll create more work than you need to. You need to look at the setup questions, the questions about history and about what people are adding to the map. You can tweak those just a little. Pretty easy tweaks. Most of the moves, I think, you leave alone. You go and you look at the list of surpluses, the list of resources, and you tweak those to fit with the setting. Super easy to do. That's the big thing. And then maybe add a few custom moves. But I think reskinning is pretty easy. I have done a reskin of Free from the Yoke with L5R. I did a lot more on rechanging the playbooks and things like that, which was fine, and creating some new things there. But a lot of it was figuring out some of the cultural touchstones and feels and keeping things relatively the same. I eventually want to do a sort of Dune style, Fading Sun style version of this. But the real question for me is how we handle the map and how we handle travel, like warp lines and things. So that's something I've been thinking about and chewing on. One of the nice things about this game is it like most PBTA, it doesn't give a shit about balance. So you don't really have to worry about that too much, which is fine. I'd also look, if you haven't already, number one, Free from the Yoke. Free from the Yoke adds probably for me the most interesting thing, which is there is a central figure, the arbiter, who is setting the agenda. And all the players have to position themselves in relation to that agenda, in relation to that arbiter. And it always gives players a thing that if I'm not doing something else, I can always be working for or against what the arbiter wants. That's a really interesting role. It centralizes things. It provides a pole to build the rest of the game around. There are some other things that Free from the Yoke does, like it has a PvP and a dueling mechanics, which are interesting to borrow and to take a look at. But that's the thing I think is really worth taking from. Shattered City has a lot more mechanics to it. But if I were going to point to two things that I would take from it to bring to other games, it would be one, it plays with that treaty system. Like there, it adds some dimensions to like what your relationship is that I think are interesting to look at and consider. The other thing it does, when you do the map building at the start, you put a thing down on the map and then you associate an asset with it. So it isn't just this cool color thing, but it also has like, okay, if I want this resource or if I want this thing or if I want to do this, it is in these places. And I think that's something to potentially borrow for Legacy or reskin or a hack or something like that.
I just wanted to add in my third pick as well from Shattered City. Yeah, you kind of actually alluded to this sort of thing earlier in discussion on like how to start the game, but I adore the council session that you have in Shattered City. It's specifically built into part of the structure of play. Because again, as I mentioned before, in Shattered City, the concept is that you are all factions working in a city and in more or less uneasy alliance with one another. And you do have kind of like a central council. And it has this great little setup where each player has to suggest like one, I think it's like one problem, opportunity or something else happening around the city. And they nominate another faction, who another house, another family, basically, who have to deal with that. And you know, it's not like a binding thing, but it's a kind of, it's a really interesting way of getting just more like threats and complications out there in the world, but also kind of tying that into like actionable things. Mm-hmm. It's also like always inevitably gets really passive aggressive in a way that feels very appropriate for like that kind of town council type setup. And it's also again can be another interesting way of introducing other characters from the family who's in, because for instance, if you're playing like the rugged explorer type, you probably aren't your family's representative on the council, so it gives you a chance to sort of flip into another character mode and all that sort of thing. So I really like that mechanic. I think that's something I would probably introduce an equivalent of that if I were running base legs.
Interesting. Well. Yep. Yeah. David, there's a question that Dan put to you in the chat there. What do you think is the best way to ease players into this more sort of top-down thinking about gameplay, especially when they're used to sort of the street-level action of most RPGs?
Yeah, I was halfway through typing a response to that, but I think it can be a tricky thing. I think it is, if nothing else, I think it's just in part a kind of familiarity and sort of getting used to it sort of thing from a player perspective. But I think one of the things I think can help is it's in some ways breaking some of the golden rules of Apocalypse World, where I think if a player rather than the kind of the traditional things sort of modeled in the Apocalypse World of like you sit back and you let the players do their thing and then maybe it's just a move or whatever and then roll with the fiction. I tend to be a bit more so if someone says, my character's going to go and travel over here and find out more about this and talk to this person, it's like, okay, that's cool, but you can just get your house to do that. That's the thing, they can just you can use this move instead. Because your house does this thing or whatever, and just kind of introduce like the different ways of, rather than thinking just in the process of being like one person. It's like, yeah, if you are playing that your house is your house is like the elder playbook where you're kind of this old master of the family kind of thing, then yeah, why are you leading an expedition into the wilderness? Why aren't you just using the explore the world? It's not called explore the wilderness, but use the family move that lets you find stuff out, because that's what your family is there for, is to do the stuff that you can't do, and vice versa. So I think that's kind of quite an important thing to get across is like thinking, rather than just thinking, okay, I am playing this character and I want to do this thing, so I have to do this thing. Actually, I have a whole, organization that I can call on. What things can the organization do? What things can my character do?
Yeah.
I think it's just kind of looking at it in slightly different ways.
And also giving the player then the opportunity to, like, when that family move triggers, like, and narrate how their player was maybe involved with it or did it without them having to roll the character moves, giving them the opportunity to add themselves into the fiction as well. All right. Well, I think this is where we're going to stop. We've talked about a lot here. I want to thank you all for surviving these 2 hours with me talking. I really appreciate everybody's coming and bringing your insight. I do love Legacy. I do want to run it again. I have really ideas for what I want to do. And it is one of my favorite games. And I think it gets smoother and easier each time I run it. And I'm glad to hear that other people dig it enough to talk about it.
Well, now I'm kind of mad because now you put this legacy Ars Magica hat in my head now, right? I didn't have that before today, right? And then you talked about reskinning and hacking it.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, why would you do that? This game's perfect.
Different different covenants. Each covenant has a different thing. You do Mythic Europe. You send your wizards to that convocation. And then you had the council session. Oh, yeah. Oh, fall of Britain. Oh,
Yep. Like, I don't have enough things to do. Right?
Yeah, seriously.
So thank you for that. I appreciate that.
Thanks, everybody.
Hello, and thanks for listening. This episode is part of the Open Hearth Gaming community. You can find out more about us at openhearthgaming.com. We also have a Patreon at patreon.com/openhearthgaming. And if you want to check out our gaming calendar, you can find that at app.playable.io. And check out our community page there that has our calendar with everything that we do. Thank you so much for listening.